EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments.
All right. And so we are back again, another episode, EMS on the Mountain for 2025. Look at that, 2025, three glorious years.
Dude, we're so amazing. I love us.
Or just 4 years. I don't know.
Anyway, I don't know either.
My brain doesn't keep track of time. So today, folks, this is going to be a multi-topic episode. First thing we're going to talk about is I call it universal decision to load and go or stay in play, as they like to put it. Although we're definitely going to talk about it in a wilderness context right now.
Yeah, we are.
There's a lot more stay and play in the wilderness just because of the tyranny of distance.
You like that?
That's your DOD buzz phrase of the day.
Is that a common
the tyranny of distance?
The tyranny of distance.
Right. Things out are the harder it gets. So you're in the woods. You've got a patient. You show up and it's like one of those, should we linger, play with this thing, see if we can fix it? Or is it one of those, must load in basket, call helicopter, go away fast kind of decisions?
Fundamentally, okay, so anybody that's ever done medicine ever, that ever took an EMT class or a woofer class or whatever class or LMNOPQRS class, this concept in EMS that just won't die, that I personally hate, it's the concept of load and go or stay and play. Now, back when I was a fledgling EMT, because I was the good, diligent student, I was learning what they were teaching me, I always worried about, I got to make the decision pretty quick whether it's really critical patient and I got to throw them in the back of the truck and run to the hospital, or whether or not I should stay here and try to stabilize them first. The problem is that we've talked about it as a binary for so long in medicine that we still talk about it as a binary choice. Mm-hmm. The question is not, should we stay here and quote-unquote play? I also hate that term. We are not playing. We are practicing medicine. We are professionals practicing care. We are not playing with anything. There's no fucking Legos on the floor. Barbie isn't fucking here. Man, I'm feeling spicy today.
Yeah, you are. This. Oh, folks, what did we get to the top?
Oh, man, this is going to be a great episode. But anyway, the term stay and play, there's no playing. But it's talked about, you have to make an early decision to go toward definitive care or not. Here's my exception to this. A skilled paramedic in a reasonably progressive system can do pretty much most of the things that somebody in the emergency room is going to do for you to stabilize you before they go to fix the root problem. And the more we hurry to get in the back of a unit and go toward the doctor place, the less efficacy or risk of complication, or more risk of complication, we introduce, right? This is borne out quite effectively in the rapid progression of pre-hospital blood product being pushed out into the field, right? There was a study a couple of months ago about, is it better to throw a cop that's been shot in the back of a squad car and drive him to the hospital, or let the medics come and treat him? Yeah, that's a corner case. But in general, as a general statement, that study did also point out that even if you're like 6 blocks from the hospital, it was done in Philly.
Yeah.
Getting the blood on board sooner is better than waiting until you get to the hospital, because there's a bunch of other administrative hurdles to get it done at the hospital. And if they weren't ready for you, they may have to get it from the pharmacy or the blood store or wherever it is in the building, and yada, yada. It's always better to do what you can sooner than wait to get to the hospital. So in general, that's my rant on stay and play. It's a dumb concept. It's not like we stopped providing care because we got in the ambulance within 3 minutes of picking up the dude that got schwacked by a semi versus 10 minutes into the unit because I wanted to do things like stabilize the leg that was dangling by a tendon and get some IV started and get pre-hospital blood product on board, get some pain management, whatever the case may be, right? Extrications. Oh, as soon as we cut him out of the car, drive fast. Diesel does... time and time again, diesel has been proven to not make an appreciable impact on patient outcomes, right? Going faster doesn't help. Proper care does.
Yeah.
The fuck are we going to do in the woods? Because now it's never a matter of how fast are we going to extricate. Not if you're any appreciable distance from definitive care.
Yeah.
But what's your mindset around how fast do we have to get the ball rolling? And here's my baseline, and then we will discuss. There's no such thing as hurrying in the woods. There really shouldn't be any such thing as hurrying in a more traditional pre-hospital environment. There's appropriate care in an efficient manner. What's the definition of efficiency in the wilderness? It's all the things. If you are on the hasty team, this is a common concept for those that don't do the walking in the woods thing. You will send a hasty contingent, typically of a higher level provider if you have them, or at a minimum, one or two individuals that are tasked with getting boots on the ground and moving toward the incident while other individuals are bringing things like baskets and additional medical equipment, warming equipment, whatever, all the other stuff, right? More shit equals harder to carry in the woods. It's simple physics. If you're on the hasty team, you want to work efficiently to stabilize your patient and be ready to extricate so that you don't spend a bunch of time waiting once the additional extrication equipment arrives. Yeah, I guess the concept is be efficient, but there's no hurrying, right? You need to bring the appropriate equipment and then stabilize them where they are because that's the only option you got. There's no staying or playing or going. It's stay here until you get enough help to get them out.
Yeah, I think the biggest differentiator, and I'm with you, I hate those terms that get used in the schoolhouse environment so much, is it's not so much about how fast we have to get moving, because as you pointed out, for those who are practicing it in legitimate wilderness and austere environments, time is already extended beyond normal time, right? It's already essentially a quote stay and play scenario. What I think it is the prioritization of resources. Do I have to try and find the aviation asset, right? Do I have to try and make up as much time as I can, knowing that I still have a lot of time with the patient? So depending on where you're at, you're probably going to be, usually, even for us, with a fairly close aviation asset that can come and hoist a patient and the provider, about at least an hour.
Yep.
Right? So by the time somebody, whether that's the initial, like the closest EMS provider, EMT through paramedic, can get on scene and go, oh yeah, they're really jacked. Hopefully it's somebody that understands the legitimate need for a helicopter and doesn't. Because otherwise, you can always turn them off. I get that. But understanding that, okay, yeah, they are altered mental, significant trauma, whatever it is, go, okay, it sounds legit. Let's get that aviation asset moving. Knowing that those guys have to spin up the flight time to your remote and austere area is not just 10 minutes from the local helo base along a highway, right? Like for traditional HEMS sorts of linkups.
Yep.
There could be some significant stuff. There's also they're getting a grid or a lat long reference, and they've got to circle around and actually find you. And for those of us that work in, and where Mike and I are, we have some really pretty dense woods with some very narrow clearings. Fortunately for the primary helo agency that we work with for the hoisting stuff, we have pre-identified hoist spots, and they generally have those programmed, or they're supposed to be programmed into their flight GPS systems.
Yep.
So they have a general idea, but still, if they can't see you, they don't 100% certain they're in the right spot, because there should be a group of rescuers there. And if they can't see you there, they're going to start circling and looking around, and notoriously, communications between aviation and ground assets is not always the best.
I've never had it go super well ever, personally.
Aside from that, which, yeah, hit or miss. Sometimes it works out great. Sometimes it's just the nature of the work. It's still, you still have a time frame, like where you've got an hour. This is no longer a 15 minutes or less on scene with a severe trauma kind of thing, mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, yep, that's really bad. Let's get them in the unit. Let's get rolling. This is a, okay, this is really bad. Let's get rolling to nothing. It's okay. I now have to stabilize, do my job as a provider, whatever your provider level is. You have to do all those foundational things. Stop the bleeding, start the breathing, take the airway, treat for shock. That's some more old school military for you right there.
Yeah. I like it. Don't forget to crank.
Hell yeah, crank it.
Crank it.
It's the first thing I check every morning when I get on the unit. Is my crank kit ready?
Crank kit ready.
Scalpel, bougie, tube. Let's do it. That's actually not half wrong. Because one day I'm going to need that kit and I'm going to crack it open and find nobody replaced a scalpel in the hole.
It's a good thing you got a
tube they used, but.
Good thing you got a. Actually, OB kits don't really come with scalpels.
No, our OB kits come with scissors, those not scalpels. Scissors. So, yeah.
You got a. Dude, it's fine. You got a Bic pen and a fucking.
I got a Leatherman with me. I'm good.
You got this. You'll be all right.
So you have to do that. You know, what is. It's no longer RSI rapid sequence induction. It's resuscitation.
Resuscitated, yeah.
Which.
I like the term. It's fine. Whatever.
I think it's a little. Come on, guys. We can quit saying that in 2025. I'd like to think that. I know a lot of agencies don't, but.
2026.
It's 2025, Michael.
I know. They're not going to stop saying it until at least 2026.
Oh, yeah. No, they're going to keep it. It's just going to be the new term.
Yeah.
Just like it's a rapid sequence intubation, not an induction.
Right.
Anyway, you have to do those foundational things first. Assess your patient. Find out what's wrong. Treat those life threats. Get them all packaged up. And like you said, you have to realize, okay, if this is going to be a carry out situation, we're going out by ground and they're going to be carried in a litter. Then you got to start prepping and do what you can to help prepare for packaging for that. So yeah, when the litter gets there, litter's assembled, litter's ready to go. You can transfer your patient over, get them in secured and off you go. Or if you're expecting same thing, helicopter stuff, if you've already got some little foamy earplugs, you can already have stuffed in their ears, get some eye protection for them so that when that basket and helicopter comes overhead and debris starts flying everywhere.
Because you're a kind soul.
Because you're a good provider, right? Yeah. I'm a kind and generous provider. But I think that's the big difference is the prioritization of assets. Do I really need to get a basket moving? Can we do this? Our areas become famous for the send crutches first. Let's see if we can get them to crutch and walk for a bit first.
That is a standard.
And I'm absolutely 100% not opposed to that because it's, if you've got an isolated, lower extremity, predominantly ankle and foot injury, and we can get you crutching down a trail, it is much faster for you to get off the trail and then to the ambulance or into your Honda and get down to the local hospital for better definitive care. Whereas if you have to wait for the basket and the carry team and the carry out, you've extended your what could have been an hour slow hobble to 4 hours of a slow walk in a litter thing. So I think that's the big difference is prioritizing your evacuation method. Do I really need to try and find aviation assets for this?
Right.
Or realistically, as you and I have done on a few occasions, can we just bivouac overnight instead of trying to do all this in the dark? Is this patient stable enough that you can essentially do an impromptu camping trip with them, set up a little shelter, get them all warm and tucked in, feed them, get them some nice hot cocoa, and spend the night with them, and then have a full team ready to go early in the morning, showing up at sunrise, basically, with a litter and a carryout team ready to go.
Yep.
Because, again, sometimes depending on where you're at, doing the extract at night in the dark might not be a good idea. Right. There might be a greater risk of continued injury, not just for the patient, but for the providers and the rescuers as well.
Now, the flip side is you're going to be carrying them out. I'm still going to advocate for it. Don't hurry for the purpose of hurrying. But this is where time matters, right? It's not so much in the hoisting. It's not so much in the, I'll call it the critical patient. It's the twisted ankle. It's the broken kneecap patient, right? This is where I think the concept of do what you need to, but get the keep progressing the call sometimes gets lost. We spend too much time talking about what we think we want to do versus taking some action. And this could just be my experience, but we've touched on this a little bit before, which seems to be the theme now that we're 3 or 4 years into this thing. But there's a lot of, hey, I got there with the stuff and now I want to hang out and wait. The work is not over. We need to get them out of the woods. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do I think the Hasty team needs to get up there and get the ball rolling? Absolutely. Do we need to be conscious, I guess, is the term I'm looking for? Be aware of the fact that we need to continue to progress the call, even if once the stabilization is done, once the IV is started, if you're going to do that. And I'm actually thinking I'm going to start less and less IVs in the woods now after listening to a 3-hour podcast on IV access and the implications of. Did you get medications on board? Are they stable? Are they happy? Can you start moving toward definitive care? Because they still need to go to the doctor place. So I think sometimes we worry too much about getting the sick person out of the woods, but we do need to keep in mind that getting them out of the woods is the ultimate goal, and doing it as efficiently as possible is important. So I guess I'm saying both are valid, but it isn't a dichotomy. You have to stabilize. You have to do what needs to be done to keep them comfortable. I don't know that I will ever have a patient in a Stokes anymore that will not get some sort of anesthesia or analgesia, not anesthesia, analgesia, because it's got to suck to be in a basket. And after thinking about it the last couple of weeks, like, why wouldn't I provide comfort to my patients that are in a strapped down discomfort state? I got the tools. I got some ketamine. Let's take this ride.
And I will say, even for someone with, again, that isolated lower extremity injury where they can't walk, so they've got to get carried. Mm-hmm. Even if they were like, no, I'm good with my pain right now. I don't want anything. They don't want any fentanyl. They don't want ketamine. The pain it's there, but it's tolerable. They just can't walk on it. I will still try and get them to take some Motrin Tylenol combo, A, to help with that pain, and B, laying in that Stokes for the next 4 hours, your back and everything is still going to start to hurt. And let's just try to make the whole experience a little bit more comfortable.
Yeah.
Like, I can't take away, they don't fully appreciate, and again, we talked about this one before, it's hard to appreciate what the patient experiences being in the Stokes until you've been in the Stokes. And so I try to preload them with at least some OTCs and keep that up depending on the duration. Just again, it makes like that low back pain, because you're never going to be able to pad the voids and all that other textbook stuff as well as you would like.
Yep.
Unless you've got a good full body vacuum splint, which you and I always, I know, try to use whenever possible.
Yep.
But it doesn't always make it out there. And if it didn't make it when the first crew comes, we're not going to wait an hour and a half for another crew to run one up here. Let's get moving. Because again, as you mentioned, we got to keep the rescue progressing.
Yep. We got to keep
we're not going to stop. Right. Yeah. So it's okay. We're going to do the best we can with you here. Swallow these. Let's get these on board. Or I'll start them with the Toradol IV or intramuscular, and then follow it up in a bit with the oral, just traditional OTCs, just because some of those just general discomforts will start to pop up and make the extrication for the patient worse.
Yeah.
So I agree with you 100%. Like, I always like to at least give OTCs just to help with some of that just general discomfort they're going to experience in the next 2 to 6 hours of being carried out of the woods.
Let me see how I can help you.
Yeah. And of course, you and I, we've been partners together up on many a call. We are always offering, all right, do you want the good pain meds or the okay pain meds?
Yep.
Would you like fentanyl? Have you ever been high before?
Would you like to be?
Would you like to try it in a controlled environment under supervision? So, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm with you on that. And I think it's, yeah, the wilderness for traditional, we'll call it traditional wilderness and austere stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if you're on ship, an oil rig, an isolated station somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Okay, cool. You've got a pretty decent, robust clinic, but you're still out in the middle of nowhere, and it's going to take time if you have to get that really sick or really injured patient out.
Mm-hmm.
The whole concept of the stay and play and load and go, it's to become one thing, because you're going to stay and play because you have time before your whatever your rescue apparatus is, whether that's feet in a basket, a truck, or a helicopter. And then it's And then it is, okay, now we transition to phase two, which is let's load and let's go. Mm-hmm. And I think the big thing, and this is just something that I've observed over the years, when it comes to the carryouts especially, people tend to forget the patient, and then it becomes all about carryout team comfort. We need rest. It's no, this train doesn't stop.
Yep.
We don't put this litter down. You just switch out people carrying. Use whatever technique you want to do that to switch people out. Now, I get it. If you've only got six people to manage the litter, because that's all that's available.
Right.
Okay. Rests have to occur.
Right.
But if you've got 10, 12 people or more, especially the more, yeah, that litter doesn't stop. It's a nonstop move, right? Like, why are we stopping? You will rest when you're not carrying the litter.
You will rest when you're dead.
That's right. There's plenty of time to rest when you're dead.
All right, let's transition to the Wilderness Medical Society recommendations that you wanted to talk about. This is going to be fun.
All right, so this was an article published in the Wilderness Medicine Magazine, a product of the Wilderness Medical Society, which I have a love-hate relationship with. The article was...
to hate them.
Not quite, but it's getting there.
Yeah.
So we're going to leave their names out. If you're a WMS member or subscriber, then you'll be able to track this article down pretty quick. It was written by a couple of physicians, and the title of the article is An Evidence-Based First Aid Kit. A, they don't cite shit for evidence, right? Which is disappointing. They give two references, two books. I'm not saying those books are bad. The books are good. One is written by one of the most prolific and respected authors since passed away in the world of wilderness medicine. Those aren't bad books.
You talk about Auerbach? I didn't realize he passed away.
Yeah, a couple years ago.
Okay.
So the books themselves aren't bad, but if that's your evidence-based stuff, you are already woefully behind the curve. This smacks of the Correntio, you published something to say you published something, even though what you published was shit. And I won't say this article's complete shit. I would say this article is appropriate if you are not a trained medical provider. It is more appropriate than if you are an actual trained provider, especially at the advanced levels, at least paramedic and above.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's, I have some stuff. So they start out with, and we have discussed this topic a couple of times, especially the early first year episodes. We talked a lot about gear and what we load and what don't load and things to think about. So basics, they start off environmental group factors. Obviously, it should be appropriate to the number of people you're caring for and the environment you're going into, right? If you're going on a rafting trip, all your kit better be waterproof. And when I say waterproof, waterproof, not just moisture resistant. Same with your mountains, high altitude, alpine environment, deserts, whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. Those that still remain the same, valid points. Basics, container sturdy, easily acceptable, protected from the environment. Yep, should be clearly labeled, 100%. All group members should be aware of the kit location and content. Agreed, right? Especially if you're working, and this is written in the perspective of going on, we'll call it expedition type
adventures,
right? Not individual first aid kits, or we'll call them wilderness EMS type kits, even though it should be more like that. Progressing on, they talk a little bit about obtaining medications and supplies. This is most appropriate when you're traveling overseas. Most of your supplies, you should have already boxed and shipped with you for your expedition. Mm-hmm. It's the drugs piece that becomes a conundrum, because some countries have very strict laws of what you can and cannot import, even for official, we'll call it expedition reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Bringing narcotics into some countries, regardless of reason, is verboten and can literally result in a death penalty.
I just don't get caught.
There's that, right? Whose bag is this? Fuck, it's not mine. Not my name.
That's
on
why
that bitch.
I always keister my fentanyl.
Okay. Oh my God. Let's not start there. So obviously, you either have to have an overseas contact to pick up the supplies legally. Okay. We're going to caveat that with all of this at the legally.
Should they probably say the phrase now, don't break the law. We are not advocating you break the law.
No, I would never. Like
the members of the EMS on the mountain are not advocating that anyone break the law.
Especially when it comes to drugs. That's just bad.
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
All right. They do provide some links and some other stuff if you're interested in going to the article and clicking on some of the additional resources they have linked in here. Now, here's some of my interesting stuff. The medical literature recommendations. All right. And we're just going to go down the list in the article, and we're going to discuss things as they pop up that we find interesting. Number one, IV access. Okay. This is always, I won't say a source of contention, but is always debated. Should we be getting IV access in a wilderness and austere environment? And the answer is always, of course, it depends. Challenges are posed, of course, they bring up the issues of sterility and infection. I would say if it's done properly, there's no more infection risk than there is with anybody you pick up in the U.S. in an ambulance. If you think all of those folks are clean and healthy, you should get on an ambulance and actually see what's going on out in the world.
Yeah.
And I get it. Starting an IV in the woods or other austere locations. And based on this article, we're going to talk pretty much strictly in the woods or wood-like. Could be a desert environment, but actual out in the outdoors environments, not like remote gas oil platform stuff. Certainly some risks you should be aware of. But if it's a thing your patient requires, then it's a thing your patient requires. Mm-hmm. And I think this applies regardless of your location. Like for me, if I'm in the ambulance and my patient does not need an IV or IV access, I don't just start IVs because the nurses like it if I do it.
Yeah, nurses don't like me anyway, so I'm not really going to impress them.
If my patient does not require me to gain IV access, unless you have a protocol that requires you to do, then by all means, follow your local protocols. But if I have a BLS patient that requires no advanced anything, like they don't need fluids, they're most likely not going to need a lab draw, IV meds administered, etc., then I'm not going to just start an IV just because I'm a paramedic and I can start an IV, right? That's just, anyway, that's enough on that. And so, of course, they recommend.
How are you going to define your success as a human, as a paramedic?
You know, how am I going to do that if I can't count the number of IVs I've started?
Yeah, got
successful innovations every year. They do reference the TCCC, for those that aren't familiar with the acronym, the Tactical Combat Casualty Care Guidelines, which are military guidelines, not civilian, pure military guidelines. Considering wilderness IV access only for patients with acute hemorrhagic shock or who require IV medication. And to that I say, no shit, right? Like we just covered that. If they don't require IV fluids or IV medications, why would you start an IV?
Yeah.
That's just, I don't know. I call that advanced care 101.
It's called good medicine, my friend.
And referencing military stuff is not, in my opinion, the best reference for civilian wilderness EMS, right? There are some lessons to be learned in certain things, for sure. But determining whether you should give an IV or not is not one of them, because a lot of these are based under a lot of care under fire, red zone, fucking yellow zone stuff. Like,
yep.
It's not a priority. Like everybody lost their minds when the TCCC new guidelines came out and they took out like IGLs or supraglottics. And we can discuss that on a later episode.
Yeah.
It's two different environments, folks.
So what you're saying is if you're getting shot at, don't take the time to start an IV.
Yeah. Unless my patient no shit needs it right now.
Right.
Yeah. And
yeah. Turns out bad people are coming and we should probably address the threat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And as they mentioned, which is a legitimate, valid point, most of your meds have other alternate routes. Intranasal is probably the best, in my opinion, just because absorption, blah, 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 is good. If you know how to do proper IN administration, most people don't. And we're not going to discuss how to properly do it. If you don't, for the love of God, go get trained.
Read the manufacturer's guideline.
And of course, intramuscular, you can always give the injection of just about everything as well.
Yep.
And this is particular for the wilderness folks, usually revolves around analgesics. If I'm just going to give you some fentanyl, I can shoot it up your nose if I need to, or give you an IM injection. But yeah, the IM is going to take a little longer to work. It's not going to be as effective because of the absorption, blah, blah, blah. We're not going to get into that science today either. But there are alternate routes. And I think a big one with IV access that everybody else needs to remember, if in your environment you're wearing a lot of down clothing, stripping your patient out to get access to a vein may not be the best idea either.
It's mean.
And we'll just leave it at that. So the last line in there, consider IV access if in a base camp setting or anticipate significant delayed rescue. They used to or anticipate significant delayed rescue on a lot of things, and I can't say that I necessarily support that as a reason to do certain things. Because some of these things, if you do them knowing you're going to be delayed, which I don't know what they consider a significant delayed rescue is necessarily in this article. I didn't go back and reference the two books, even though they're in a bookshelf right behind me. Everything in the wilderness is a delayed rescue.
Yeah, fair.
Let's just make that assumption off the top. If it's not for your particular event, like you're literally like you're rafting down some river creek, pretty slow moving thing, and there's a road that parallels it not far away.
Yeah, great. That's going to make it faster to get out, I think.
Yeah, say good on you. But that's usually not the case. So yeah, IV access. I don't have too much heartache with what they got there, other than I wouldn't have picked TCCC guidelines as my guiding factor. I would have just used common pre-hospital.
I thought you were going to say common sense.
I am. And I would say hospital-based medicine, but you can't charge for it if you don't do it.
That's fair. Yeah. If you don't sign the 12 lead, you can't charge for it.
Next one. And this one gets Mike and I both, especially Mike, a little bit fired. Airway management. Okay. Folks, you've heard us talk about airway management in various scenarios several times on the podcast. I think we even did an entire episode or two devoted specifically to airway. If you're in a wilderness airway or wilderness environment and your patient requires legitimate airway management, you are in deep shit. And I don't care if that's basic BLS adjuncts of an OPA. That means the patient is unable to maintain their own airway, which means mentally your patient is gorked and things went sideways fast and you're now hosed. So of course, the great logic, this will free NPAs and OPAs free up the rescuer from maneuvers such as a draw thrust. No shit.
Also, they still have to be breathing.
And NPAs are preferred due to better tolerance in patients with a higher GCS. Well, if the patient's got a higher GCS and they can't maintain an airway and you had to put an NPA in, how high can the GCS really be? Asking for a friend. Four.
How about six? We'll call it a six.
Sure. I've met threes that are breathing fine. That just means they're unresponsive.
Yeah, they're just very not responsive.
But they're breathing on their own.
I might have done it too. My bad.
Oh my God.
Too much of the devil's juice, if you will.
Folks, it's way too early in the morning for this.
Yeah.
Anyway. Second point, I love it. Sentence number two, consider endotracheal intubation equipment if anticipated prolonged time to rescue.
I'm just going to say it. That is the worst idea ever. If it is a prolonged time to rescue,
always prolonged time to rescue.
Do not tube them. Tubing them bad.
Well, and I get, okay, so again, head wound, vomiting, they need to protect the airway. You've got to breathe for them. Great. You've determined that whatever the adventure I'm going on, I'm an advanced provider and I want to take intubation supplies with me. All right. Great. You've made that choice.
I'm happy for you.
Okay. Good for you. Like, I don't care. It's a personal choice. Mike and I both pick and choose based on initial patient reports and what we think might be going on. And we take a very bare minimum kit. So here's the thing. And then they go on to say, oh, though it retires additional skill, resources, blah, blah, blah. And then they say, oh, LMAs, I'll just go with any supraglottic, offers an alternative airway requiring less equipment. And to that, I would say less equipment by a 10cc syringe and some sort of introduction device, bougie or stylet. Okay, that you saved yourself two things.
Yep.
And maybe more appropriate than intubation in a pre-hospital setting. No, they're both advanced airways, right? One's just, we'll say, slightly better than the other. Here's the thing. If you're expecting prolonged rescue, which in the wilderness environment, it's all prolonged time to rescue, are you capable of bagging your patient for this prolonged time?
Yeah.
If the answer is no, guess what? Johnny's going to die, right? If you, and nobody's going out on these, okay, I won't say nobody. Somebody might be going out on these large expeditions with a battery-operated transport vent, whatever variety you want to pick. I don't care. But the likelihood is slim.
Yeah,
they are battery-operated. There's a finite time they will function, and then they're done. And then it's on you, right? This is the number one thing. Number two, if you're going to intubate your patient, do you have the drugs necessary to support it for a prolonged time till extrication?
Yeah.
The paralytics, okay, one and done, right? There's no reason to paralyze past the first one. Can you keep your patient comfortably sedated and with an analgesic for your 1, 2, 4, 6, 12, 18, 24 hours? Do you have the meds for that? If the answer is no, intubation should be out the window.
Yep.
Anyway.
You just said the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
Don't tube them if you can't manage it.
Yeah. If you cannot manage it, just as you would in the hospital, minus a vent, I'll give it. You can do it manually.
Yep.
But you have to be prepared for that, and you've got it. You can't have people wake up. Okay, yes, you could extubate, certainly, but then I'd question your need for initial intubation.
Right.
It is what it is. So if you think you're going to go on something where the potential for traumatic injury is so great that you truly feel you might have to intubate someone, you had best bring all of the things. Bringing your whatever MAC 3, couple of tubes, and a pocket BVM without requisite drugs, then at that point, you're essentially intubating a corpse if that's going to happen, right?
Yep.
Like they're in cardiac arrest or they are fully uptunded GCS3 trauma case. Man, Godspeed, good luck, right? Anyway, enough on that. Next one. This is great. Again, ventilation. Recommend a pocket mask. Why a pocket mask? Because it's small, it's light, easy to pack. If you have to breathe for your patient, pocket mask isn't the answer. If you think you're going to be in a scenario where you have to breathe for your patient, it's a BVM or nothing. Okay,
yep.
I won't say nothing. But you're going out, again, this is people who are planning to go out creating a first aid kit for an expedition type event. Pocket mask is not the answer for patient ventilation. BVM is, right? You're just out hiking and you're a wellness first aider, or you're a paramedic and you're out hiking and you just in your basic first aid kit, your backpack that you always carry, because I know you always all do. You're not one of these assholes that says I'll use sticks and duct tape. We've had that talk before too. Okay, sure. Pocket mask, one of those little pocket CPR face shields for the emergent witnessed cardiac arrest at the trailhead where some sort of response can occur fairly soon. I'm on board. As your source of ventilation for an expedition, you're an asshole if all you brought was a face mask, right? If all you got's a pocket mask, holy shit, surrender whatever credential it is you think you have, right? BVM or nothing. Like, and they make plenty of, not plenty, there's basically one company that makes compact BVMs. Bring one. They're Bring small. One. They're not that heavy. Mike and I have them in our backpacks. Come on, guys.
Turns out they don't suck.
Yeah. Because if you got to breathe for somebody, let's do it. They worry about increased bulking cost. Yes, they cost more money. And yes, they're more bulky. But again, if you're anticipating having to breathe for a patient, and again, I'm keep saying patient because you're going out as a medical provider for an expedition. They're your patient. Come on, guys. Next, suction. Consider bulb suction. I'm going to say, I'm hoping when I read this, when they say bulb suction, they mean something like the squid, like a big bulb suction device, not like the little blue thing you get for the peds and your OB kits. Because if that's what you brought, again,
enjoy.
Shame on you. Turn in your credentials.
Yep.
Right. Now I get suction is difficult. Improvisation of mechanical suction devices. Yeah, you can do it. It's not the best way. I have an improvised suction device that I carry with me in my general kit all the time. but I also have a larger suction item. Again, this is based on patient presentation. But if you're packing for just general use for we're going on this 15-day expedition and you have no idea what you're getting into because it won't happen until you're there, you need to bring a legitimate suction type device, at least one, right? The odds of this happening more than once on an expedition.
Man, you're having a bad
expedition. Right? Like it's some bad stuff happened. All right. So yes, having some sort of portable, lightweight, and states mechanical suction device. Who's it? Laerdal makes that big.
Laerdal, yeah.
Big squeezy one, give you that good strong forearm pump. It works.
It'll last about 3 minutes.
Yes, it works.
Before you're tired. But yeah.
Yes, yeah, your forearm's going to hurt for days after. You're going to get the DOMS for sure.
Yep.
But they do function. And then the squid, which is essentially a giant bulb syringe, it works. It's not the best, but it does truly work.
Yep.
I've played with them. You need to have something. Don't count on improvising one in the heat of the moment, right? Like if you think this is something you might need, then actually have an actual manufactured device ready for it. They make some pretty small, lightweight ones. There's no reason to improvise that if you think that's going to be a legit need. Oxygen.
Unless you're willing to suck their vomit out of their face with your face with a like an 80 tube, there's
and
nothing
not.
Else you're going to improvise
and
to
I'm
solve
not.
That. It's funny.
Yeah. And again, lastly, they bring up oxygen. Obviously, if you're going on high altitude expeditions, you're going to climb Everest or some other over the 14s peak. Oxygen's probably already going to be somewhere in the kits and available.
Yep.
This is something that for just general wilderness work, I don't necessarily advocate for oxygen. People are like, oh, but what if they have a hypoxic event? Start breathing for them, right? We already function it on we'll call it room air. And again, if it's an expedition and you're really that concerned, have whatever your expedition trip, invest in carbon fiber, bring at least one relatively lightweight O2 bottle. If you're truly worried about oxygen and oxygenation.
Yep.
But this is that's a tricky one. Again, they do mention air travel with it. That's a thing. It's compressed gas. So you either have to have an availability to get it filled at your destination or pick one up at your destination. And depending on where you're going, you might get stuck with some janky steel tanks, which, hey, if they're holding oxygen, which who knows what you're getting overseas, right? Not everything's as regulated as it is in the US or most of your normal European countries. If you're, it's particularly the Asian countries is where you can run into some kind of sketchy shit.
Man.
It's just the nature of the, you go to you're going to go into Germany, France, Italy, like doing something in the Alps. Those countries all have regulated stuff about O2 purity for medical grade oxygen and everything else, just like we do.
Yep.
But you roll into Malaysia for some jungle trek, man, you honestly have no idea what you're going to get from some local O2 vendor. I'm sure they have some statute, but I know that I picked up some oxygen from a local medical facility and it's, dude, is this even really going to be oxygen? Like you're looking at some rusty old steel tanks and stuff. It's,
yeah.
No, but here it is. We got it. Let's go.
How high did you get?
Didn't.
No. I thought maybe it was nitrous.
Yeah, that would have been pretty interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyway.
Any more comments on airway stuff, Mike? I think I ranted on that one enough.
No. It's fine. You're not gonna bag someone through a mask, a pocket face mask, and I'm not sure why we're bringing tubes. But let's move on.
Yeah. Again, if you really think you're gonna need it, then you have to bring all the supplies. And I don't just mean the mechanical pieces. The drugs is the big and most important one, right?
Yep.
I can't stress that enough. Okay. Cardiac arrest.
Turns out that's bad.
This is just Sean's personal opinion. Witnessed, unwitnessed. If you have a cardiac arrest in an austere environment.
That sucks, man.
If you didn't get Ross within 10 minutes of CPR, guess what, folks? Let's be honest, right? It wasn't going to happen. It's statistically, cardiac arrest is what it is. It's not the most survivable event a human's ever going to experience.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers are against you. The mention of AEDs.
Mm.
they do mention there's less utility in wilderness, remote, out of hospital arrest due to length of time, right?
Yep.
That is probably one of the smartest comments they have is, sure, you could bring one, but let's be honest. You're remote, the time it takes, boom, done. The last sentence of that first one, prioritize excellent CPR and rapid activation of an EMS system. If you're in the remote and austere wilderness setting, EMS is still not close, right? You can do all the CPR you want for an hour. Man, if you don't have ROSC, you could have the dude drop next to you, start immediate, perfect CPR, be running the most brilliant set of chest compressions. You had enough forethought to bring a tube just in case of a cardiac arrest, intubated, you're bagging. Okay, we're at 30 minutes, we're done. Personally, in the woods, I think Park Service, did they reduce that to 15 or 20 minutes?
I think so. I'd have to look, but I think
I'd have to look it up. But it's realistically, folks, cardiac arrests in the wilderness, austere setting, it's not really a cardiac arrest. It's a death kind of situation.
Yeah, right? Unfortunately, that is the truth.
That's just the reality of it. Like, I'm not telling you to not give them the old college try. You're more than welcome to. I'm not going to watch somebody go down next to me and not do CPR and try. But the reality is, humping even a relatively compact, because they make some really small AEDs now, right? They're just a couple pounds. They only have a charge for, I think, 2-3 shocks. The utility of one, again, I'm not sold yet. It's one of those things that, again, if
you're
taking
out... My big thing with cardiac arrest in the woods in general, it's not the doing or not doing or the getting ROSC or the not getting ROSC. It's the palliative care after you get ROSC. All of that is a lot of work, right?
Again,
it takes a lot of supplies. And I don't want to sound like I'm being this negative Nancy, completely unrealistic provider here. And there's exceptions to the rule. But as a general statement, there's a lot of work that goes into cardiac arrest mitigation that is required. And in the wilderness, it's hard to have those supplies.
Yeah, seriously. Like, you need legit cardiac monitoring. You need... Yeah. So anyway, they do on the final point in that one, do mention epinephrine, your standard cardiac dose, 1 to 10 of all the drugs. No, you can't call this an evidence-based thing for first aid kits and then mention epinephrine and cardiac arrest because the evidence isn't there to support its efficacy.
Yeah.
The only evidence that we have is that it's not bad per se.
Right.
But it's definitely not good. I remember the last updates, AHA, everybody's expecting epi to be gone, and they kept it in with the logic of, we know it doesn't really do anything, but it also doesn't hurt, so...
It doesn't hurt, so we'll be
just keep giving it.
Yep.
All right, if you want to carry cardiac epi or the ability to build it yourself, cool. Again, if you have the ability to carry epi, I have other reasons why you might want that, but sure.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
This is another one that made Mike and I... What the fuck are we thinking? Major hemorrhage and trauma. Number one, tourniquets. Yes, they are indeed first line for controlling life-threatening extremity bleeding. Yep, gotcha. Good. And then they follow that with...
Here it comes.
There's little evidence to support intermittent perfusion. This is correct, right? The loosen it, tighten it thing, thinking you're going to just let little bits of...
And by little evidence, it's... Pretty much been proven that it doesn't.
It's pretty much been proven that it doesn't do shit, right?
Yep.
Now, tourniquets should not be released. No shit. You know what? They should be converted, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody who studied prolonged care, which is what all wilderness stuff is, if you have the opportunity, and this is even in the TCCC guidelines, folks, tourniquet conversion should be attempted. And again, if we're anticipating being out for multiple hours, they reference limbs can tolerate up to 6 hours of ischemia. So give or take, yep, you put that tourniquet on, you got about 6 hours before things start to die to a point where they might not be able to necessarily fix it. If we're in the wilderness and austere setting and you're not already anticipating a 6-hour evacuation, your planning factors, either you're not in the wilderness and austere environment or you've got some amazing resources available to you.
Oh, I couldn't get to the mute button fast enough. Sorry about that.
That's right. That's what editing's for.
Yeah.
I'll look at it.
So yeah, like I agree. Doing the little crack the valve every 15 minutes thing. Yep. Nope. That's not been proven to be any value. But tourniquet conversion has been, right? So yep. You got your wound. Holy shit, this is really bad. You toss a tourniquet. You control the bleeding. Give it a half hour. Bleeding's still controlled. Pack it. Put on a good solid pressure dressing if you want to use hemostatics, whatever.
Sweet.
Great. And then nice, gently, slowly follow whatever your local protocols are for tourniquet conversion. I'll assume you have them if you're going to attempt it.
Yep.
Some places say wait an hour, wait 2 hours, whatever. Give things time to clot significantly. And then you're going to slowly back that tourniquet off. And if it holds, awesome. Right.
Sweet.
Let the rest of that limb get as much blood flow as possible. Keep an eye on that thing. Good to go. So just to say that should not be released, I think is disingenuous. If you're going to cite TCCC for IV access, you should cite some TCCC for tourniquet conversion, because that is a thing, especially in the world of prolonged field care, which in my opinion is most of wilderness EMS or wilderness care. We won't say necessarily EMS in this case. I just think that should be in your bag of tools and your scope to be able to do, right? If you're thinking you're going to need to start carrying tourniquets, which they recommend carrying multiple tourniquets in case of failure, either quit buying tourniquets from Temu and Amazon, right? If you're not carrying legit, like softies, cats, like a legit no shit tourniquet. And for those of you who are into the bungee tourniquet one, the rats. But just buy bungee cords at Home Depot if you're going to do that thing. But it works. Yeah. So does kite string if wound tightly and long enough, right? I'm certainly not going to tell you not to carry a tourniquet. Tourniquets have an application, but carrying multiple tourniquets, sure. If you think that you're going to encounter a lot of bad chainsaw and hatchet accidents, carry multiple tourniquets. Or if you're expecting to be mauled by bears on the regular, whatever.
Also, stay away from the chainsaws.
It does mention improvised tourniquets. No. Again, if you're expecting to come across a significant trauma event on your trip, and I would say you should probably at least have one good tourniquet with you at a minimum. Improvising a tourniquet, that is one of the things that just you should not try to improvise. Some studies will find that, yes, if done right, it works. 9 out of 10, it isn't done right and it doesn't work. Don't be that asshole that lets somebody die because you're too cheap to spend $40 on a good quality tourniquet and bring it with you.
Yep.
Enough on that. Hemostatics.
They're awesome.
I'm not going to tell you no. I never tell anybody no on hemostatics. They certainly work. The new modern generations that are all out there, all good, high quality things. And we're not going to talk about why and how they work. Do you have some available? I'm not going to tell you no, but if you carry enough gauze, you can get the same work done. It may not be as effective, or we'll call it as efficient,
right,
necessarily, but you can get the same work done with traditional rolled gauze, right?
Yep.
But if you want to carry some hemostatics, make it gauze. Don't make it hemostatic pads. What are you going to do with a 4x4 hemostatic pad? Nobody's cut is going to be so bad that you have to put a hemostatic on a laceration. And if you're packing a wound with a 4x4 hemostatic pad, again, you're an asshole. What are you thinking? So if you're going to carry hemostatics, make sure it's legit gauze that you can pack a wound with.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we're going to say on that. Because then if you want to put it on that really bad laceration on somebody's forearm from filleting a fish,
you can.
Well, then you can cut a little strip off and put it on there if it makes you feel better.
Yeah, I agree. That's really what this is all about, feeling better about yourself.
So here's where I'm going to have another issue, right? Good when direct pressure and tourniquets are not possible. 100% agree with that. Such as junctional or abdominal. Folks, we don't pack the abdomen. Like, you are never going to get enough gauze, or you're not going to carry enough gauze to pack the abdomen enough to apply enough pressure to slow bleeding, right? The whole thing hemostatic gauze is you have to get it up against the bleeding thing.
It's got to be there to help,
right? It can't just be in the general vicinity, right? That's not how they work. It has to be up against the bleeding thing. You can't just start packing abdominal wounds or chest wounds, right? The chest cavity itself. There's a great video. It's been circling around the EMS social medias of a cop packing. I can't tell if it's a, I think it's a chest wound.
Yeah.
Right. That guy is shoving gauze. Like,
I know which one you're talking about. Like, yeah. He's putting in the work.
He's trying. And I commend him, right?
Yeah.
He's doing what he can for his partner or fellow law enforcement officers. Like, good on you. He's doing what he's been trained to do. Guys, just know. And if you don't know that already at this point, again, surrender said credential, right? We pack limbs, tourniquet limbs, pack junctions, and seal the box, as it were.
Yeah.
Right? You seal put the occlusives on chest and abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to let that go. And then lastly in here, referencing tension pneumos. Holy balls.
I mean,
you're not sure if you need IVs. You're not sure if you need intubation supplies, etc. But we should definitely carry some 14-gauge angiocaths. Are reasonable to include for decompression.
Yeah, cool. Sounds good. Let's decompress. What are we doing here?
But yeah, like, I mean, seriously?
Why don't we just do thoracostomies? It's fine.
I'm with you on that.
I get the whole cutting people open and infection and all that shit. But at the end of the day, I've never darted somebody and been like, oh, that's going to solve it for a while. They ultimately have to get somewhere where they're going to fix it. It will become a tension pneumo again.
That's the thing, right? It's going to tension again. If it's tensioned once, it's going to do it again. And if it's tensioned, and again, I would anticipate more so than in the urban environment, right, on our normal ambulances, tension pneumo presentation in the backcountry and wilderness where you have your patient for a longer time and you will actually see the presentation of a tension pneumo, much greater chance.
Yep. Also, you better be flying them.
Ah, shit.
Because they need a surgeon.
There's a lot of problems, right?
Yep.
Could certain adventures that our folks are going on in these expeditions result in a tension pneumo situation? Oh, 100%, right? Whitewater rafting, climbing. There's any number of injury patterns that could lead to a punctured lung and a resulting tension pneumo. Carrying a couple of 14 gauges, even if you carry the good new NAR stuff, right?
Yeah.
That's not going to get it done, right? Mike said, if you really at that point where you've got to relieve a tension, you really should be considering finger thoracostomy, right? I'm 100% on board with that because you need to, no shit, definitively fix it. You're going to have to fix it again, but if you've already got the incision, and we're not going to get into should I install a chest tube kind of thing because that's a whole other.
Yeah, we're not putting chest.
Deep discussion, right?
Suturing chest tubes in the middle of the woods.
Right? Like you can slap on some Tegaderm over the top of that site. And if you've got to go back in there, you don't actually have to cut another one.
No.
Right?
Just de-Tegaderm.
Yeah, so you sling that piece of Tegaderm off, get your Kellys, stuff them back in there, get your finger back in the hole, reburp it, get the air out. Maybe the blood's got to drain, whatever your problem is. Seal it back up and
you got a different problem if you're still draining blood too, if you're in the woods. But yeah,
again, we're at a point where we've got tension presentation, we've got your patient needs to be moving out of the woods. It is what it is.
Yeah, I hope you hit the red button on your spot locator
before
you did this.
Anaphylaxis, obviously they mentioned epi 1-to-1 first line 100%. Auto injectors, great. As they mentioned, convenient but costly. This is true.
I love this part. Epinephrine should be stored at 20 to 25 degrees Celsius. However, for wilderness temperatures, that has had no effect. Doesn't have an effect when you're in the wilderness? Epi doesn't have a temperature thing. That's what this is saying.
I would say, okay, yeah, you got to keep your epi liquid, obviously.
Yeah.
The only thing that I would say that temperature comes in is if your patient is hypothermic and they're vascular perfusion is poor, then yes, giving that IM shot to the thigh is going to take a lot longer for it to perfuse into the body and do its work.
Yeah.
I will 100% buy that. I'm not going to do any serious research about epinephrine that's colder than 20 degrees Celsius. And obviously, if it freezes, any drug that freezes is going to have probably some sort of reduction in efficacy because it just messes with chemical compound of the drug itself when it freezes and forms crystals and other things.
Yep.
It is what it is. Just like any other drug you're going to carry, you got to keep it protected from the environment. Enough said on that. They do reference a couple of times the risk of needle stick injury. Holy shit, people.
Yeah, don't bring needles if you're scared of needle sticks.
Yeah, if you're really don't that worried up. About needle sticks, given IM medications.
I will give the authors a pass. They are doctors. They don't deal with needle. That's a nurse's problem. But
okay, you're not wrong. And again, this is not necessarily a dig on doctors, folks. This is, doctors have a different perspective of medicine. Like, they went to school billions of times smarter in medicine than me. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, if like needle stick is your concern about bringing IM injection supplies, Jesus fuck. Don't go out as the expedition medical person. Just don't, or don't bring drugs where that's a concern. Just, it is what it is. I will say that an EpiPen has multiple doses of epinephrine in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole milligram of epinephrine in an adult EpiPen. And if you know how to, in the wilderness and austere setting, only if approved by your local protocols and medical direction, blah, 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 there is a technique to gain access to said ampule, turn it into an injectable syringe, and use those other two doses. Same with peds, right? A peds Epi Junior still has a full milligram of epinephrine in it, yep. Even though it's only dosing, you know, peds doses and adults only dosing adult doses, right?
It's just spritzing.
Right. They both have a full milligram in them. And if you know how to get to those, you have additional doses that you could use in an emergent situation. That's one of those times where wilderness improvisation could be beneficial to your patient if you only have a couple of EpiPens. We're not going to talk about anaphylaxis and why that might be a thing, but it is. So, yes, you need to have some way to treat anaphylaxis if you're going to a region where there are things that could cause it, right? If you're taking an expedition down the jungles in Panama, nobody's sure if they're allergic to anything in the Panamanian jungle, you better have some epinephrine. You're taking Boy Scouts on a long camping trip, and Billy didn't know he was allergic to raspberries until he had his first one, you should probably have some epinephrine.
Yeah.
That's just one of those drugs I think should be in everybody's planned kits, regardless of anything else. Like, you just don't know who's going to be allergic to what until it's too late.
Yeah, I tend to strap it with some sort of Benadryl or something similar.
And then that's what I say is, but of course, first line is always going to be the epi, and then you can chase that with some Benadryl. You can start playing with steroids later if you need to, but it is what it is. For me personally, I would always choose vials simply for the fact that as an advanced provider, if I need to make a dirty epi drip, push dose epi for other reasons, I have the epinephrine I can do that with. If all my epinephrine is only in an auto-injector EpiPen, and I don't carry other vials for things I might need them for.
Mm-hmm.
Personal choice. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying vials are a bit more multipurpose, right? Because again, you can switch concentrations. You could use them in a cardiac arrest, push dose pressors, dirty drips, whatever you want to call them. All right. So that's pretty standard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Analgesias. I like they lead off with the WOS recommended OTCs. The Tylenol Motrin combo, huge fan. Like, pretty easy to acquire anywhere. You can pretty much travel with those things everywhere you go. I don't know if there's quantity restrictions if you're flying and traveling with them. Like, you can't bring in your Costco size 500 meh pill bottles. But I would certainly always recommend OTCs. I'm a huge fan of using those in the wilderness environment. Opioids, obviously, these are your preferreds for that acute pain. Even in wilderness environment, I like to use lead with a little fentanyl, get that pain blunted, chase that immediately with some OTCs so that as that fentanyl wears off, or the morphine, whatever your opioid of choice is, as that's wearing off, the OTCs are taking effect and you're keeping that pain management train rolling. And obviously, the traveling with opioids is a big tricky thing, which I would toss ketamine into that box as well.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a consideration if you're doing expeditions overseas, particularly. You can get your, I'm sure there's a, some sort of DEA form if you're traveling from the U.S. up to Alaska to transport these drugs with you as part of an expedition. Just like flying with a firearm, as long as you follow the appropriate rules.
Yeah, as long as you follow the rules.
You can do these things. So I'm sure U.S.-based, not an issue. It's when you're traveling overseas that you really got to pay attention to this stuff, right? Oral opioids. This is one of the things that I like about our overseas counterparts. They do, and the military is big on this now too, right? Getting your fentanyl lollipops.
Yeah. Like, I'm a big fan of them.
Yeah.
I've never personally put one in my face, but I've heard they're great.
Yeah, no, I would love to have access to them for us. And if that's something you can have, I 100% support using those. Great option. And again, one of those prevents you from having to do intramuscular, intranasal, IV access. Here, suck on this green apple delicious thing that's going to make you feel better, mm-hmm. right? Don't crunch it. You can only suck on it. And I think this is another one where our friends, especially the Brits, on the green whistle, right? Like methyl flexo, whatever, fluorine thing. That's a great choice. WMS did a good article about the U.S. kind of studying bringing those back to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Because the U.S. got rid of that drug just because it can cause some really harsh kidney damage. But at the lower dosing that they're putting in these things as a portable analgesic device, not so much. So there's some options out there that aren't an opioid that are, I would say, good enough at least.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to maybe get as great of pain management without using, you know, the fentanyl, ketamine, or morphine list of drugs, but you can at least do something for the pain, right? Even if it is just OTC, Tylenol, Motrin, you've got options. I think we're just going to leave it at that. That paragraph's fairly decent, right?
Yeah, not horrible.
Wound care. All right, so this is obviously beyond your normal bleeding stuff. Abscesses. Okay. We're worried about infection with an IV access or a needle. Yet we're going to consider incision and drainage kits with scalp. Come on, guys. Pick whether you want to be worried about infection or not. If I've got to take my scalpel and cut into your carbuncle, your furuncle, big ol' abscess and drain it in the woods.
You're having a bad day.
Yeah, this is a crazy trip you're on, right?
Mm.
This is something I would say if you're functioning at a base camp type clinic, yeah, definitely you should have. Much more controlled environment. Hopefully you're stocked and you've got antibiotics. You can help worry about the infection. You can clean it properly. Mm-hmm. Actually try to do a relatively sterile field with it. Okay. On board. But you're citing concerns about IV access with infection. And here we're going to do a whole incision and drainage kit. Come on, guys. But again, if you're out and you think this is something you might need, and I would say if you're going down in the tropics, there are certain insects that can, or other items that can cause these large infections, which can create literally just giant golf ball sized things that pus fairly quickly that need to get cut out. It's fun. They're disgusting to work on. I've done some really good stuff. But then you got to remember, it's not just the initial incision and drainage. You've got to be able to pack that thing with sterile dressings and change it regular and everything else. So
that's exactly what I was going to say. I'm not opposed to, hey, if somebody's got a massive abscess and it has to be dealt with, though, I'm going to ask, does it have to be dealt with right now? Like an abscess is an abscess. It can stay there for a little while before you get to the doctor place. That is the quintessential definition of front country when the abscess has been there for months and Timmy finally goes to the hospital and is like,
and they finally go,
this thing, it's, I don't understand. It's slowly growing. And they're like, oh, you've got an abscess. We should deal with this.
Let's deal with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed.
But if you feel like you have to address it, you got to go back to the wound packing and wound maintenance equipment. And do you have the right stuff? And do you have enough of it? And are you going to be able to address this problem? Because it turns out that you can't just puncture an abscess or something and then be like, oh, we're good.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously. Chasing that one, they discuss irrigation and they do rightly state the use of any potable water is acceptable. If it's clean enough to drink, it's clean enough to irrigate a wound. Like simple as that. It doesn't have to be anything, no special mixtures, nothing. This is simple irrigation. Just knocking the essentially surface level debris out so you can do a good dress it and get it ready. They do talk about using syringes or other devices for pressure irrigation, which I'm not opposed of. I, a small little plastic tip that's designed to screw onto a syringe for a little pressure irrigation.
Yep, I'm familiar.
I mean, you can squeeze your Camelback nice and tight and get a little pressure behind it. There's ways you can do this if you really think you need the extra pressure. But they do say to avoid soap or antiseptics, as these can lead to impaired wound healing. And I know that's basically because of some of the other chemicals contained in soaps, like moisturizers and some other things that can cause issues. So just if you're going to, the best thing to do is clean the site topically around it as best you can, irrigate it out, and then just do a good dressing and make sure you switch out those dressings as often as required, at least every other day at a minimum, just to keep that thing clean. And if you got to get to a point where it's starting to look pretty gnarly and stuff, hey, at that point, man, get some soap in there and clean it out as best you can. Try to prevent that infection. And we're talking about expeditions where you're out for days before you can get somebody extracted.
Yep.
Wound closure. Unless, again, this goes back to the, unless you're functioning in an austere clinic setting, I'm not a fan of suturing for general wilderness practice. Unless you're carrying antibiotics where you know that when I sew in the funk that I have a way to kill it from the inside through antibiotics, I would avoid suturing. That's just me.
Yeah. And avoid sewing in the proverbial funk.
Yeah. They do state grossly contaminated wounds should be packed open with wet to dry dressings to heal by secondary intention or delayed closure. 100% agree. As a state, most other wounds can safely be closed. Sutures are, they say, staples, obviously a misprint, meaning staples. Again, if it's not that bad, use some simple butterfly closures, some Steri-Strips, whatever it is. Again, stitching or suturing. Again, we're worried about needle stick infections with IVs and drugs. Suturing's in the same, contamination worries are there, right?
Yeah.
You're not doing it in a controlled emergency department or clinical setting. If you're doing this in the woods, those infection concerns are still present. You need to think about that before you start doing that. Clean it out good, Steri-Strip it, or just pack it and keep changing those dressings until you get out. Infection. All right. We probably talked about most of this again. So a lot of this goes into your trip planning, like where are you going? What's prevalent? And I would say infection should not just be wound infection, but you need to think about vector-borne disease and illness as well. Any sort of prophylactic meds people need taken, malaria, etc. They do talk about, which is pretty good, just general soft tissue injuries, general like cephalexin. I always hate saying that one. I'm never good at that one. Which is, it's an antibiotic Mike and I both have in our wilderness kits for the primary, the open fracture scenario, where if you have an open fracture, it's best to get those antibiotics going sooner rather than later. That's what they're primarily used for. We don't use them for anything else.
Correct.
Which, and again, we're not out so long for ours. We're not expedition necessary, right? So we're an hour's delay thing before we can get them to a hospital and get things cleaned out, get an actual doc to look at it, prescribe an appropriate dose of antibiotics or whatever. They talk about some other stuff. GU, antibiotics again, Cipro, Doxy, etc. If you think urinary tract infections are going to be an issue, pack accordingly. Same with GI, and they do mention it. And this is one of those things that I would say probably 99% of GI related things are preventable through hygiene. And
yeah. This is something I was going to say the same thing. Hygiene solves a lot of these problems.
Right. As the expedition medic person, you are the one that has to enforce the, did you just shit? Good. Let me see you wash your hands. Right. Oh, we're about to eat? Good. Let me watch everybody wash their hands. What hand sanitizer, soap and water, whatever you're using, that is going to prevent a huge majority of your GI issues. But if you think you might come across some crazy stuff, again, this is one of those traveling overseas. People didn't purify their water. Hell, they took a trip to Colorado sheep hunting and they didn't purify their water. Well, guess what, my friend? You've got a GI bug that's going to flush you out. Then you're going to want to give IV fluids.
Yeah.
Pneumonia. I would not worry about treating pneumonia through antibiotics, an expedition trip. That's a patient that needs to be evacuated. Pneumonia is not a, let's just hang out in the field, kind of the stay and play thing, right?
That's, yep.
Holy shit. You need to go to a doctor. We need chest x-rays. You need, like, we need to know what kind of fluids gathering.
Yeah.
Pneumonia.
It's a thing, right?
That's not treatment. You've just got the sniffles, right? Pneumonia kills folks.
It's bad.
And again, wound prophylaxis, some general antibiotics recommendation. I would agree.
It felt like a lot.
Yeah. And it's, I would just say, just good general wound management. Now, if you have somebody that laceration, they took a fall, got some abrasions, clean them with just good clean water. You can buy medical soaps, right? Like the same soap they're going to clean you with in a hospital. Scrub you down, get those no dyes, no moisturizers, no scents, like just clean, plain soap.
Yep.
Scrub that stuff up, bandage it up, keep it clean. And that's the key, keeping it clean in this environment. And generally, you're probably going to be all right. If you want to carry some general purpose antibiotics, I'm certainly not going to fault you for it, especially if you're out on a longer duration expedition, because those things earlier is always better than later. And will help prevent further worsening infections. Ocular complaints.
You should probably extricate quickly. In my opinion.
Identifying corneal defects using fluorescein stain and a pen light. Sure. If you want to. Like if you're suspecting corneal abrasions.
You know what they're having trouble seeing. The hospital when you get there? Treat the corneal problem.
That's why. This goes back to a lot of widgetry in pre-hospital medicine of. Hey, we should take this. Why? Do you suspect corneal abrasion? Is it painful to the eye? Does it look like there might be an abrasion? Can they see, right? If they've got blurry, jacked vision, it hurts to use the eye. It's an eye injury until proven otherwise. They need to be evacuated. You squirting stuff in their face going, oh, yep, that's an abrasion. Okay.
Yep, still there.
Still there.
Yep.
Right? Like one of those, okay, let's give it till tomorrow morning. If it hasn't better overnight with a good rest, then... we're getting you out. Like, I don't know. Again, if you want to take, all this stuff, people, good on you. I don't care. Like if your stuff's all packed in Pelican boxes or other, some ruggedized containers in the back of a vehicle, take it all, take all of it. Here's another one. Unless you're working in the austere clinic, the urinary emergency or urologic emergencies, consider an 18 French Coudé Foley. Really? Of all the things you're worried about infection on.
Yeah, you're going to bring a Foley?
Yeah. God damn, people. Right? Now, super pubic decompression, right? Needle and syringe. That's a doctor. I'm not playing that one. I'm not going to inject into your bladder and manually drain your urine. And I would if I had to, and I was functioning in that environment. But this is definitely...
Is that the thing we're worried about?
Well, yeah, because... usually these things outside of traumatic injury. And again, if somebody's injured enough to cause a bladder problem and urinary retention where I've got to insert a Foley, they should already be on their way out kind of thing, right? Before this Foley becomes a necessity.
Right.
That's just, it's me. And again, unless you're doing this in a we'll call it a more controlled environment in an austere clinical setting. I mean, look how obsessed with sterility and everything our hospitals are with inserting Foleys, just because the infection risk is off the charts when doing this, we'll call it emergently in the field. Man, talk about infection risk.
Yeah.
Because right? think about it. Just bringing a Foley kit, like that whole package tray of all the sterile crap, right? That's, and not getting it damaged, compromised, or anything else. That's in and of itself a pretty good task and feat by itself, right? And then performing an emergent field Foley. That's a little aggressive, optimistic. I don't know what you want to call that one.
Foolish? I don't know what the, yeah.
Yeah. You can tell this definitely has a physician bent to it.
For sure.
And I don't want to be too mean, but it's also got the flavors of somebody who's never worked out of a backpack. right? That somebody that's even, they've been on an expedition, a trip, and they either never had to address any of these legit problems, just think, oh, this might be a good idea if you have it. Because some of these things, like bringing along a Foley kit, right?
Yep.
Sure. Standard or coup de tip, your choice. Bring the coup de just in case it's difficult and you got to push past some on board. Really, the necessity of a Foley kit is a little suspect. Again, not saying it won't happen. Somebody out there's probably got some story of, there was this time, no shit, there we were in Kenya going to Kilimanjaro and I had to do this thing. Taking some IV tubing and I had to spit on the tip and get it in there and drain a bladder. Okay, cool. Let's start to be a little bit more realistic. And I think this is where the experience and knowing your most used things and what you should really be focusing on bringing are. And they give you a sample med kit, some analgesics, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, oxycodone, cardiac aspirin. Chet starts having some chest pain, radiating down his arm or shortness of breath. He's looking like ass.
You've got
here's some aspirin, and you need to immediately activate whatever it is your emergency evacuation system is, because he needs to go.
Yep.
Because again, unless you're carrying a monitor and you can definitively, without question, disprove any cardiac sort of involvement, it is what it is until proven otherwise.
Yep. Agreed.
Allergy stuff, pretty standard. Same thing with the infection. We talked about a lot of the antibiotics and such. Same thing. GI, here's a big one, like Miralax, Loperamide, Tums, Bismuth, like all these things, Famotidine. Those are all when you get the runs, basically, and you have that upset stomach, right? Pepto pills, things like that, 100%. Keep those simple OTC meds. Will probably take care of 90% of your issues. Well, I'd say probably 95% of your issues. It's those outliers that are going to cause you the trouble. And they do mention like Zofran for nausea, rehydration salts. I wouldn't necessarily put that with GI, but yeah, if you get the runs, you drink some bad water, ate some bad fish. Rehydration salts, that should just be part of your kit and everybody else's kit regardless. Albuterol, prednisone for pulmonary issues. If you got the ability to run NEBS, great. If not, you're stuck with doing just steroid treatments, which is generally the case, especially on mountaineering expeditions. Very few people are carrying NEBS.
Yeah.
Because it's such a temporizing measure. That's, if they're starting to have serious pulmonary issues, that's an evacuation thing.
I don't know what you neb them and then what? Then you neb them again?
That's the thing, right? It's a pulmonary issue. It's get the steroids. I know it's the longer acting, slower acting, but you got to start taking care of the big problem and evacuation. Anything that's cardiovascular or pulmonary has to go home. There's no more hanging out. That's, we're out of the stay and play, right?
Yeah.
You don't get to hang out on the expedition. The canoe trip is over for you.
Yeah.
And some other miscellaneous wound care, bleeding things. We're not going to talk too much about that. Ortho, SAM splints, ACE bandages, triangle bandages. 100,000 billion times percent, yes.
Yep.
No sticks, no duct tape. Stop it. My favorite, miscellaneous. Foley catheter, sure, why not?
Sure.
Best one ever, pregnancy test.
Yeah.
How long is your expedition? If you have a woman of childbearing age with severe abdominal pain, she's going pregnant. With the old school, she's pregnant, it's ectopic, and she has to go home.
Yeah. On the stick is not going to result in a change in procedure.
Oh, I just have some nausea, vomiting, blah, blah, blah. Are you pregnant? No. Is there a chance you are pregnant? No. Do you have sex with people? I do. So there's a chance you could be pregnant.
There's a chance you're pregnant.
Here's the thing. I can't disprove it. Pregnancy, like the home pregnancy tests, well, they've made leaps and bounds over the old days, back in the 70s, 80s. There's still plenty of false positives because it's based on certain protein markers and some other stuff that I'm not saying. Even those manufacturers are going to tell you that, no, we are definitely not 100%. Don't count on us for being positive or negative.
Right.
If you think one way or the other, follow up with a physician. And in my opinion, if you think a woman's symptoms, which are being unresolved every morning she's hurling, and I think maybe it's just morning sickness, cool. She's otherwise stable and performing. She's able to eat, maintain fluids, keep food down.
Yep.
Okay, you may continue until it gets worse and we think, nope, now it's time to go home. Pregnancy test, you're not going to sell me on that one.
No, we don't need them. Done.
Yeah, like I'm just, you're not going to sell me on that one. I'd rather you have switched that out and your fluorescein strips for your eyeball with some urine dipstick stuff. So we can see, is there blood in your urine? Do you have excess protein in your urines, right?
Yep.
Those would be, in my opinion, more beneficial on a longer expedition trip to see how bad somebody's body function might be.
Yep.
Than a pregnancy test. But that's me. All right. And that's the end of that. Like I said, it's not that it's all wrong, broken. It's just some of the focus areas. It's like, why? Like, why are we bringing a pregnancy test? Why are you're super concerned about infection with an IV stick, but you're recommending incising and draining some sort of lesion, inserting Foleys. It's, come on, guys.
Yeah. The lot, like the math ain't mathing.
Yeah. It's, and if you're going to make this general article, well, we really meant that for a clinical setting with the Everest Base Camp. Okay. Then you should make a separate article about manning an austere clinic recommended supplies. Cause then you can start putting things like cardiac monitors and AEDs and Foleys and pregnancy tests and all kinds of epochs, like whatever you want. If you're at an established clinic, even though it's in a remote location and it's pretty sparse, yeah, sure. Have the things. But if you're talking about putting these in the back of the Land Rover, your whitewater raft, your backpack, there's better things to be carrying, right?
Yeah.
It could be a better focused list. I'm not saying the list we've put out are any better, any worse.
Unless you're really trying to make sure you didn't get that girl pregnant, but that still takes some time, man.
Yeah, and again, I don't know how long.
And ladies, stay away from the long-haired guide gentleman that just lives his life 1/4 mile at a time and smokes weed every night.
Can't be that big of a turn on. Yeah,
can't be that big turn on.
I guess it depends on how crunchy you are.
Yeah, fair.
Perhaps he's got good weed, and he's a hacky sack man.
And he's a hacky sack man. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, again, it's not like the article's horrible. It's just, I think, yeah, the perspective some people have of what medicine in the wilderness is, this one isn't as bad as some of the things I've seen. And then you fall into some of those articles and lists, and it's like one of those, tell me nothing about wilderness medicine without telling me nothing about wilderness medicine, right?
Yeah.
This article isn't that bad.
I don't know, dude. Don't get me wrong. Catheters and pregnancy tests.
Yeah. And again, maybe they meant that in a clinical setting. I don't know.
Yeah.
They make good valid points on some things, like your kit should be well marked. It should be protected. People need to know where it's at. And I'm 100% on board with that. Like, we need to tell somebody, go and get the medical kit. People need to know where the medical kit is to be able to go and get it to help you out.
Yeah.
If it's your kit, you need to be able to tell people where something is in it so that they can hand it to you. If your gloves are covered in goo and blood, you should not be reaching back in there. You should have an assistant saying, hand me gauze, and they should know what gauze is and where it's at.
Yeah. Fair.
Great points there. General care stuff. Good. Could there be some improvements in this? Yes. Overall, is it a bad article? I won't say it's a bad article, but I would expect better out of the Wilderness Medical Society. But that's just me. I've seen pictures of their conferences, and you have people playing with sticks, duct tape, and terrible splinting. Like, it makes me ill. But it is what it is.
We've talked about that enough.
Yeah.
All right, man. I think.
Yeah, this is a long one.
I think we call this a wrap.
If you don't like listening to us run our mouths for a long period of time, this is not the episode. Sorry.
Nah, too bad it's already at the end. All right. See ya.
If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us. And until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.